Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Feiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Good evening, everyone. This is Michael Charney calling in from New Hampshire, joined as always on the Middle Ground with co-host Eric Feiler, who we'll talk to in just a moment and see where on the road he is at these days. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening on the Middle Ground. Hopefully it's a nice evening or a nice afternoon wherever you are. And we always appreciate that you give us this time. It's an important thing for us to know that you're out there listening to us. We're going to talk a bit tonight. We're going to kind of continue on from last week's conversation. For those of you who remember, last week we did a survey, and we asked people what kinds of thoughts they had when they heard the words Democrat, Republican, or Independent, and we had a pretty lively conversation about that, both here and in the survey and on the Facebook page. And we thought, well, okay, so we know what we think when we hear those terms now. But I thought it would be interesting to talk about what we wish we thought of when we heard those terms, and if we had our druthers, if we were king for a day, or if we were, you know, graduated from Hogwarts and could wave a magic wand, what would we want those terms to mean to us, and what would be the perhaps some of the people or the kinds of people in elected office that that might represent that for us? So we're going to dig in a little bit on that tonight as well. It's kind of timely, I think, because for many people, there will soon be, if not already, opportunities to attend town halls as our representatives during their August recess come back home and take the time to inform us about, I'm putting on my cynical hat for a moment, to take the time to inform us about what they haven't managed to accomplish over the congressional term to date, but at the same time, hopefully take some time to listen to citizens and hear what they have to say. And so, you know, it's a chance for us to express to our elected representatives what we think they should be doing for us and what we think we want them to be representing when they carry that D or that R or that I along with them. I should also mention a couple things. There's a fair bit of cynicism out there about the August recess. I don't share that cynicism. Yes, they didn't get anything done. I think, frankly, if they spent another month, the month of August in Washington, they probably wouldn't get much more done than they've gotten in all the months to date, and perhaps coming home and going through some of these town halls is a better way for them to do their jobs for a little while. I also wanted to point out, for those of you who haven't seen it, Janine Loudon, who does Lunch for Loudon on Thursdays, has I don't know if she's created a sign or somebody else created it and she saw it, but she's got this sign that she's encouraging us to take to our town hall meetings, unlike all of the sort of rhetoric-filled or hate-filled signs that we've often seen over the past couple of cycles. This sign says, your fact-based, moderate, and civil constituents vote too. And I thought that's a really interesting thing to remind our elected representatives that it's not only the loudest voices that vote, but some of the quieter voices are voting and are paying some very close attention to what they do as well. So I do encourage everyone to, if they have the opportunity, to go to a town hall and see what your representatives are up to. We're going to talk a bit about that tonight on the Middle Ground. Another quick announcement, a little bit of, I guess it's bittersweet in some ways. Tonight will be my last show on the Middle Ground. I am sort of moving on to doing some other things, and the time that I have to devote for show prep and finding guests when we do them and coming up with themes and writing blogs about it, unfortunately, has just become somewhat difficult for me to tend to. And so, I'm hoping we hear from not only all of our regulars, but everyone else tonight, so I can hear your thoughts. I will certainly be someone who listens in now and then and downloads the archive shows, but tonight will be my last evening as show host, co-host. Shouldn't say show host. The show will and must go on. And on that note, I'm going to bring in Eric. Eric, good evening. Welcome. Where are you now? The recess is over. Are you still in North Carolina? You were heading further south to continue on the story of America tour, as I've begun to call it.
The North Carolina General Assembly session is over for 2013. Reverend Barber said at the final rally in Raleigh, North Carolina, that the legislators are going home and we're going to follow them into their districts. And that's exactly what they did this past weekend and yesterday. And we were there too. On Sunday, we were in Spruce Pine, North Carolina, beautiful little town at the top of a mountain. You have to drive this windy, windy road to get up there. And it was quite a scene because it was an all-white church, basically an all-white town. Historian Tim Tyson, author of the book Blood Don't Sign My Name, told us that in the 20s and 30s, there was basically a pogrom-style ethnic cleansing to remove African Americans from this part of the state. And to this day, it's still very white. And in comes the NAACP's president, William Barber, his entourage, which I shouldn't say entourage, but his supporters and staffers, including Tim Tyson and his father, Reverend Vernon Tyson, who really is the main character of Blood Don't Sign My Name, played by Rick Schroeder in the film made from the book. But this guy is a historical figure, 83 years old, still very much alive, and really a good ambassador between the black church and the white church. In fact, he's been doing it his entire career as a minister. And so Tim Tyson and Vernon Tyson introduced Reverend Barber, and they had set their bar very low. The aim was just to show that he wasn't a monster with horns, which is what a lot of people in the media, especially conservative media, portray him as. But it actually went much better than any of them imagined. He relied a lot on scripture and the teachings of Jesus to talk about an approach to public policy that is actually designed to help the people, including the poor, who live in your state, rather than sort of pointing at them as scapegoats or people who are leeches or takers and that sort of thing. And it actually went over incredibly well. It even went over well when they asked him about abortion and homosexuality and that sort of thing. We filmed it all, and eventually we'll share it in some form or another. The most fascinating thing about the night is that this church happens to be across the street from the house of the person who represents that Senate district, Ralph Heiss. And I don't want this to, this is just a detail. It has really nothing to do with present day, but his family was involved in the removal of African Americans from that area of the state a couple of generations ago.
His family was involved.
Not him. The guy's 35 years old.
Yeah.
So not this man. Probably not his parents, But anyway, he lives across the street. And, of course, nobody told him this was going on. In fact, it was arranged so last minute that almost nobody knew what was going on except for the people who go to this church. But it was packed full of people. And so you couldn't help but notice that something was going on if you lived across the street. And somebody who had to leave early spotted Senator Heiss skulking around in the parking lot trying to hear what was being said. And then when he was spotted, he ran back to his house, and the person who reported this back to the whole internet information sphere said that they overheard the senator enter his own house, and it's not known what he said exactly, but the response was a male voice that said, what the hell are they doing here?
It's unfortunate you didn't have all of that on tape.
I know. I was kicking myself. Why wasn't I skulking around in the parking lot? Damn.
That's right. So the difference between being a film, you have to find the line between being a filmmaker and becoming an investigative filmmaker.
Well, we do take
a little of those journalism techniques and throw them in there.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's just Annabelle was doing sound and I was doing two cameras, and so there wasn't much more we could do to cover it. But yeah, next time I'm going to post someone in the parking lot if I have some of those college kids who've been volunteering. If I have some of them with us, I'll do that. I'll hand them one of the cameras and tell them to scope out for senators.
Right. I hope you at least interviewed on camera the person who overheard all this. Were you able to do that?
We were in Asheville by the time we got wind of this, and Asheville is about 45 minutes away. It's on top of another mountain. A lot of people know Asheville. Beautiful town, kind of a college town. It's sort of the liberal bastion within the western side of the state. I posted a picture to the Story of America Facebook page, facebook.com/Story of America, that shows this enormous crowd. It was as big, if not bigger, than anything that's happened in Raleigh. And so the movement organizers are really encouraged. They're now going to a coastal city or town, I guess, next Monday. And they are taking the show on the road. Nobody's getting arrested anymore, but they still have the kind of, the star power to bring out the huge crowds because it's no longer just about the civil disobedience. It's about the message.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps no one's getting arrested there. There are other places around the country where demonstrations are going on. People are getting arrested. Texas, for example,
mm-hmm.
recently. But it's actually an encouraging story. And now the question will be: is that a novelty that occurred in that small sleepy town, small sleepy white town? But you know, if he changed one mind or opened one heart, then that was worth that trip. So and it says something for conversation that the automatic instinct was not to scream and yell and shout and down and not to let him speak, which is, I think, what would have happened 4 years ago, for example, at such a meeting.
Well,
but we were
hoping it would be the kind of environment where there might be a confrontation about who's Jesus is the real Jesus, you know, that sort of thing. But these people did not seem unfamiliar with the Jesus that Reverend Barber talks about at all. They seem very familiar, which tells me that even though they say that only 11% of the people in this county are Democrats, there probably are some liberal Republicans or liberal independents who do see the gospel and, you know, the Second Testament and all that stuff the same way that Reverend Barber does. And it also tells me that the message has gotten all the way up into this mountain enough that people knew what they were going to get if they came. And so the people who probably wouldn't have subscribed to that interpretation of the Bible didn't show up.
I also find it interesting. I wonder whether challenging, some of the biblical interpretation has ever been the right strategy in that case. Because in my experience, the even people who are, you know, sort of, you know, don't want to see welfare cut or want to see food stamps cut. There is a disconnect, and this is a very, very few people that I've spoken to, so I shouldn't overly generalize, but there's a disconnect. They would still argue, these few people that I've talked to, they would still argue that people who are really in need should have the kind of support. Now, they may argue that, government after, private charity. But they would argue there's a role for government. But the real point of antagonism there was this conception that the vast majority of people who are out there who need help really don't. They're just lazy. And if you can maybe open the eyes about the definition of who's getting this help. For example, you and I both know that rural whites make up the majority of these people who are on food stamps or below the poverty line or whatever, and that work to change the definition of who is getting these kinds of supports. They're not people who are lazy and sitting entirely in, you know, downtown urban areas who refuse to work and are having, you know, as many children as they can in order to get the extra, you know, welfare. If that image starts to go away, I think some of the true Christianity in people that we've argued with over Christianity would emerge, frankly.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much that I'm learning. The historian that I mentioned, Tim Tyson, was talking about all of the investment that has been made into negative stereotypes of African Americans, including the one you just mentioned.
Absolutely.
But also the one that really made all of this possible, the whole Jim Crow and all the suppression, even the terrorism that was not only condoned, but, you know, police cooperated with the Ku Klux Klan. That was all made possible by a set of myths about black men being dangerous, rapists, killers, sort mm-hmm. of demons, even vampires. They did political cartoons showing black men with wings and long teeth. And Tim Tyson was pointing out that, you know, that mythology was constructed right about the turn of the century. It did not exist at all during the Civil War, when so many slave-owning white men left their homes and their farms and their children and their wives under the care of their black slaves in order to go fight in the
yes.
war. There was no such mythology
right.
then. It was really constructed at the time when they had the opportunity to undo all the progress that had been made in the Reconstruction era and take away the suffrage. And take away property and basically unseat governments that had been elected when blacks and whites were allowed to form coalitions together. That was undone using the storytelling, basically the narrative that was coming out
of the
newspaper.
Well, you don't need the myths when you already have the power. You create the myths in order to reestablish the power. And
right,
I'm sure you
right.
can find a parallel between those myths emerging as the Southern white coalitions looked to regain the power that had been taken away from them after the Civil War.
Well, the thing that popped up in my mind when you said that, you know, the idea, the myth that people who are on public assistance are lazy, of course, relies heavily on the mythology created in order to justify white supremacy and Jim Crow and all that. They call it the redemption
Definitely.
Movement.
Yeah. Sure.
But also, they've also invested in stories that also do that same thing to white people as well. So, for instance, what they say about union workers, anyone who belongs to a union. And I'm thinking of teachers right now because I was actually shocked. But there's a teacher from Asheville who spoke yesterday at the big rally who said that she's feeding her children thanks to public assistance, food stamps, you know, SNAP. Even though she works full-time as a public school teacher, in North Carolina, the public school teachers qualify for food stamps. That's how little they're paid.
That's absurd.
And so it's not like people are lazy. They're working full-time. It's just we've got the system rigged such that people who work full-time, whether it's teaching our children or stocking the shelves at Walmart, they're not paid enough to eat. And so the government is forced to subsidize the profits of their employers by giving them food stamps.
Yeah, I mean we've never really talked a lot about unions. And I don't want to necessarily go off on that track right now, unless one of our callers pulls us back. There, you know, in my worldview, there's absolutely a place for unions, but in my worldview, there's also an incredible amount of overstretching by unions that have caused. Larger economic problems, and I do believe, as you do, that a living wage, that a union that can help support a living wage is a good thing. I also believe that unions absolutely have a place whenever public funds are involved, because when you have a bunch of local town officials, and that's often what it is, who control school budgets, or state officials who control the state portion of budgets, having the kinds of ideological arguments over how much money should be spent, I do believe that teachers who show up every day to teach our kids should have a level of protection from that. On the other hand, I don't believe, for example, in tenure. I don't believe in lifetime positions and those kinds of things that unions have also fought for. But nevertheless, absolutely, I agree with your point that the basic paintbrush of demonization is used in kind of the same way against various categories of people, and it's all about fundamentally stereotyping in an effort to dehumanize in order to make an ideological point. So let's get back to our topic tonight. Thank you for the update, by the way. I look forward to the film on this one, definitely, this meeting that you just witnessed in a small town. So are you still in North Carolina now? Are you still in Asheville?
We're in Durham. We drove back today.
I was in Durham. I was going to say, Asheville's a nice place to chill out for a couple of days. It is really, for those of you who, if you ever get a chance to spend a time in Asheville, it is a wonderful city. It's a, as Eric said, it's a college town. It's got good bookstores and great restaurants and culture, and so it is a wonderful place to spend a few days. Good vacation spot. In any case, let's get back on to tonight's topic, which is this, what would we want to think about when we think about the parties? And I should mention another quick point before I launch into my thinking, and then we'll take some calls. I've already taken a couple of hits on the Facebook page about this because I tend to think about two parties. And the truth is, there are other parties. We all know that. But when it comes right down to it, the vast, vast majority of people who end up getting elected do so with an R or a D next to their name. And I'm, you know, we've had the debate in the past about whether the two-party system is the right system, but it kind of is. And so for the purposes of tonight's conversation, allowing for independent candidates as well, it's kind of the axiomatic rule that I as host and creator of tonight's theme get to lay down. We can certainly talk about other parties, but fundamentally we will be talking about Republicans and Democrats for the foreseeable future when it comes to certainly higher office and for the most part, with a few exceptions, any kind of federal or gubernatorial position that's likely to be those parties. So I woke up this morning thinking about this topic, and I had this wonderful image of what this all would mean to me. And I think in images. So I was looking out to 2020, because I think it's still going to take some time before things shake out, hopefully, and the Republicans get their act together in a way that I would be more proud to say that I was a member of that party than I am today. And I had this vision that, it's January of 2017. And President Christie and Vice President Snow are being sworn in after a one-term presidency from Hillary Clinton. And not that those 4 years under Hillary Clinton were in any way bad, but just as often happens, 12 years of one party in the White House sometimes creates a sense of tiredness in America. We saw it certainly, Bush after Reagan. So I kind of had that picture that, Hillary gets to be gets the seat, gets to create history there, and has a pretty good run. But after 4 years, we're ready to make a change, and we have a moderate, and Chris Christie goes after Olympia Snow, who's been out of office, but still, can sort of carry that flag as a moderate Republican, and we're off into an era of much more centrist thinking, with just enough voices on both ends to keep people interested and to keep people honest. I haven't quite figured the picture out in terms of the corporate involvement, but I also see by 2020 we've managed to overturn Citizens United, probably because of one or two justices that Hillary Clinton was able to appoint. And so that's kind of my picture. And when I think about Republicans and Democrats that far out, I tend to think about a bit more centrism than we see today. So with that note, we've got a couple people in queue. I want to give everybody the phone number. You're listening to The Middle Ground. This is area code 646-929-2495. If you want to join the show, just press 1. We do have a couple callers in queue, and we're going to go ahead and pick up with those callers right after this short break.
Hello everyone, this is John Cashin, host of the Coffee Party Radio Civics Minute. Did you know that the Coffee Party is funded by our listeners and fans? And not by the super PACs, think tanks, or by a super wealthy individual wanting to buy the American way. The Coffee Party USA is powered by the people and your passion to bring positive change to our country. But we need your help to continue. With just a small donation, you can help us continue bringing Americans together for a dialogue that attempts to bypass the normal partisan rhetoric that is so common today. The Coffee Party USA is striving to bring you original content from editorials, fact-checking, and video documentaries, while also working to bring you the latest information from all of the 535 congressional districts. No matter what party we may belong or what issues that we follow, one thing is always clear. We are all Americans. Please go to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/donate and donate what you can to help us move our country forward, united with one voice, E Pluribus Unum. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cash.
Back to the Middle Ground. You're listening to Michael Trony with co-host Eric Beiler. Tonight we're talking about Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. What would you like to be thinking about when you think about those terms? What is your vision of what an ideal version of the each of those would be? And again, you're listening to the Middle Ground. Our phone number is 646-929-2495. We invite our callers. Please call in. If you're interested in being on the show, press 1. We know you're in queue. We'll try to get to you, find out your name and where you're calling from. But if we don't have a chance to do that and we bring you into the show, we will identify you by area code. Again, 646-929-2495 on Middle Ground. Let's go first up. I think this is Neil from Florida, but let's just double check there really quickly. Area code 954. Is this Neil?
Yes, it is.
It's Neil from C. We remembered your phone number and where you were calling from. So that's great. Nice to hear you back on the show, Neil. What's on your mind?
Yeah.
When you hear the terms Republican and Democrat, what words would you like to be associating with them?
Patriotism.
Patriotism. Okay. So that's a word that requires a bit of definition because, as you know, it's been hijacked a number of times over the past few years.
Well,
so what does that mean to you?
What it means to me is that both work on creating living wage jobs like you were talking about, caring about infrastructure, caring about the environment, doing the work for the American people and not billionaires who have this despot mentality that it's the United States of Koch brothers. It's really the United States of America. I believe that we should all care about each other. We all need to work hard. Like you were saying, the vast majority of people on any type of SNAP program are white, and 70% of them are children. Education-wise, we have to work on educating our children, making sure that we can compete with other countries. It's really not us versus them. It should be everyone together working to make this country as great and wonderful as it can be for everyone.
You know, that's not a bad definition at all. And, you know, it's interesting that you basically spoke about it from the point of view of you know, topics and outcome, not necessarily the how to get there. And obviously there will be some arguments along the way about getting there. But I agree with you. I mean, if we want, you know, I think about Republicans who care about the environment, maybe don't want to deal with it exactly the same way as everybody else would. Like I say, different what's, but recognize that the environment is something we need to deal with. And want to educate our kids and want to keep us competitive so our economy is strong and growing. I think all those things make a lot of sense. You know, there's an underlying thing, and I don't know if you thought about this when you were putting your thoughts together, but in order for all that to happen, one of the things is that both Republicans and Democrats need to be intellectually honest. They can disagree, but they need to be intellectually honest, which means our politicians have to shoot down the disinformation that the market puts out there, supposedly on their behalf.
Well,
there was an interesting – I'm sorry, go ahead, Neil.
it's a game. It's like basically, you know, we're puppets. You know, it's just basically you have all this, like I said, massive disinformation that really has nothing to do with reality. I mean, I hear the Republicans, you know, yelling about where are the jobs while they filibuster every jobs bill. The Democrats won't move anywhere when it comes to any fiscal responsibility either. But it just seems like our leaders are not representing us. They're representing, you know, from Citizens United. They're just representing billionaires. They're just representing corporations. And both are, you know, when you look at, like, Monsanto, an example, both parties are complicit in Monsanto. Fracking, both parties are making a lot of money if the pipeline goes through. Or if anything, there's a lot of people that are very heavily vested, while they keep on saying that they're opposites of a spectrum. And they're really just not taking us seriously as the American people. And I just think we've lost that. And I mean, we have to get rid of Citizens United in order to be represented, because right now it's just big money. That's all it is.
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, to me, that's all part of the idea of intellectual honesty. And in order to be intellectually honest, you have to be able to tell your own story without being beholden to others who are telling you what story to tell. And I think that's where we are today. And it's even a little bit bigger than corporations. I think you're actually talking about wholesale industrial complexes. There's a military industrial complex. There's an educational industrial complex that tends to support and feed views on the left. There is a prison industrial complex that tends to support and feed views on the right. It's more even than just corporations. It's harder and harder to point to a corporation. Monsanto is one of those that's become a standard bearer for a particular topic. But I actually get to the, you know, I start thinking that there are, and this is, I guess, not quite a conspiracy theory, because I would never go that far. But I think that there are probably other chemical companies that just love the fact that there's just one scapegoat for the industry, while the industrial chemical complex, which, by the way, does a lot of good. Let's not forget, they've done amazing things. But they also have done a fair bit of harm, right? So when was the last time anybody mentioned Bhopal and Union Carbide and Dow Chemical's response to that? No, we're all kind of focused on Monsanto. So part of me kind of thinks like they sort of just kind of take turns being the scapegoat while we ignore the bigger picture and how systemic these things really are in some cases. I don't believe for a minute that if Monsanto shut down tomorrow, the problems Monsanto apparently creates would go away.
No, Dow and everything else, they're all involved. I mean, but it's just really just wholesale selling of America. I mean, like you said, the prison population, they privatize that. It's a big money maker. They want more people in prison. It makes money. Everything wants to be privatized. They want to privatize Detroit. It seems that everything is about, you know, privatizing schools, which the Koch brothers are very pushing for as well, and other billionaires who really have a nefarious agenda that has nothing to do with patriotism. It's just I don't know, if I was a billionaire like that, I'd be enjoying life, not trying to destroy others. I would be very...
I agree with you. I think we have to be careful, though, with separating some things out. There's no question that there are, you know, people out there, and the Koch brothers, again, are that sort of poster boys for this, who you wonder... You know, how much richer do they need to be, and how much more power do they need to have? And I don't get it. I really don't get it. And I never will. And that there are people who are manipulating things like the educational stories in order to make profits. There's no question about that. That's a little different from saying whether or not privatization is a good or a bad thing in and of itself for any particular industry. If our goal is to have the best educated children that we can possibly have, then that needs to be the goal on which we agree. And we all have to be open to the fact that there may be a mix of public and private options that create that end game, and that unions may have the same or a different role in that and play that end game. And I think until We've talked a lot in the past couple of weeks within the Coffee Party about the nature of transpartisanship. Until we get to the point of saying what's the outcome that we want, and let's acknowledge that at least parts of everybody's idea may play a role in this, rather than drawing battlegrounds and battle lines. Until we can do that and accept that there are different viewpoints that may add value without getting our backs up, then I think we're going to be a long way from the transpartisan picture. Neil, as always, thanks for calling in. As I said, this is my last show, so I will say goodbye to you as host, but we may find ourselves on a show together sometime in the future.
It was
thanks
very
much. We got a couple other people in the queue. Next up, let's go to Greg out in Pennsylvania. Mr. Rusak, how are you this evening? Greg, are you there? Are you on mute? Am I on mute, Greg?
I'm on. Greg? That was me on mute. Can you hear me?
That's what I meant.
I'm still mystified by technology. You know that. Yes. I want to start off by telling you what a great joy it's been listening to you and to Eric. This has been a wonderful program. We're going to miss you, hopefully we'll hear you occasionally on other programs, or maybe even see you launch into something altogether new. But best wishes.
Well, thank you very much. And as you know, there are about 80 episodes in the archives, so you can dig me up anytime you want.
Anytime I need
it. It may not be
Charney,
topical,
but go,
it could be funny.
Absolutely. I'll catch you in a year from now on a blog or on a blog talk radio show from 2 years prior and see if it still makes sense, right? Hey, I think my suggestion would be, or I guess my wish would be, when I heard the name or the party name Democrats, would be something like along the lines of maybe New Great Society, a little combination of the New Deal and a Great Society concept. I frankly am of the opinion that the Democrats actually hold a position that's oftentimes mostly right of center, and the Republicans are just kind of off the scale. And so I'd like to see Democrats actually behave like Democrats of old. And that's why I think
define that a little bit.
Sure. I would like to see Democrats being more assertive when it comes to and Neil actually touched on a lot of this too, I think. And that is really standing up for the concerns of the middle class when it comes to things like regulation, like labor, like the environment. The idea that we've got a Democratic president in the White House and we're still trying to convince him that he shouldn't build the Keystone XL pipeline it's unfathomable to me. That's a Republican position. That's not a Democratic position. It ought to be we ought to be investing all the subsidies that go to the oil and fossil fuel industries into renewables. That to me would be Democratic. When it comes to things of social issues, here again, the notion that we are subsidizing Walmart's profits, and they are the largest private employer in the United States, employing people at minimum wage and less than 40 hours a week, and expecting that to be a wage by which people can subsist, is ridiculous. I don't know what the answer is. I just know that we need somebody. We need a party that stands up and says, you know what, Walton family? It's not going to work like that anymore. Here's how it's going to work. I don't know what the here's how going to work part is. I just know it needs to be – we need to kind of maybe think about how government policy can return some of the – dynamic that existed once before between labor and management. My father was a high school graduate. He was lucky to get there. He was born in 1915. He worked for 35 years for the Westinghouse Electric Corporation as a union wireman. He put three of his four kids through college, owned his own home, had a new car every 6 or 7 years, and occasionally went on a nice vacation. Those days are gone. And they're gone because the playing field has been tilted away from the middle class, away from labor, and too far toward not just management, but capital. Capital is now king. Wall Street and big money interests rule the world, and they rule our government. And so, you know, it all ends up being tied back together. And so what I'm hoping for, what I'm wishing for, what I'm dying for is, you know, the reincarnation of FDR, who comes in and says, I welcome your hatred. Bring it on. We're going to change things in a big way. And we're going to make sure the American public no longer listens to lies that go unchallenged. And they're going to hear it from the Democratic Party.
Well, that's interesting, because if I personally would probably find somebody like that less centrist than I would personally want. But I get what you're saying. The interesting thing, and I don't know if you've thought about this, is whether it's Democrat or Republican, part of what you're talking about is the visionary president, right? Somebody who has the big vision, and as a result of that big vision, the country unifies around it some way. And as a result, that particular president is able to make tremendous change. And in this century, I can think of three and an attempt at a fourth. You have FDR. Well, possibly you could. I'm not a historian, but you probably could maybe argue Woodrow Wilson. But you certainly have FDR with the New Deal. You have Kennedy, right, with something as simple as getting to the moon by the end of the century. Under Kennedy, we'll never know if he would have been a great president. He was an okay president in his time. And Johnson, I think, gets points for carrying out Kennedy's vision in many ways. But
especially
Kennedy had that visionary
rights.
Capability. And Reagan, right? Whether you like what he did or not, Reagan had that kind of stature. He had us all in that, you know, Cold War state. He had that Berlin Wall stuff going on.
Right.
He had enough people, enough of a vision out there that people could wrap their heads around it. And all three of these people were great communicators, which is something else. And then you have Barack Obama, who I thought was going to be a visionary president, because I thought we needed one, as opposed to, and by the way, for those listening who haven't heard me talk about this in the past, I sort of split presidents largely into they either come in as primarily visionaries or they come in as primarily operational guys, right? Who are good at the nuts and bolts of running things. Romney, for example, to me would have been an operational guy. The guy had no vision, but I think he would have done a fine job in running the country at the nuts and bolts level. Obama, I think, has exhausted his vision or has spent his political capital. And that vision of yes, we can never became anything like what an FDR or a Kennedy or a Reagan brought to the table. And he's not the greatest operational president that I've seen, although he's not bad. But it seems to me, certainly on the Democratic side, Greg, you would be arguing that kind of a personality.
Yes, without question, and everything you said, I'm in agreement with, including the fact that Reagan has to be counted among those presidents that on a I wouldn't give him that many points on vision. I give him a lot of points on communication and on style. He, for better or for worse, his acting talent translated extremely well into politics, and that shouldn't come as really a surprise to anybody.
Nope.
What is politics except public theater? And so he was tremendous at rallying the American public around a couple of themes that everybody could get excited about. You know, the idea of a recovery, right? Frankly, I think history will ultimately treat Jimmy Carter extremely well as being one of the very few presidents who never fired a shot while he was in office. Now, one might argue maybe he should have. But all that aside, that's what I'm looking for from a Democrat. And honestly, I don't see one in that party today. I don't see.
Well, that was my next
emerging
question to you.
No, I don't. Actually, the closest thing, frankly, today in my book is Bernie Sanders.
He's an independent.
Exactly.
and I don't know that Bernie Sanders strikes me as a visionary. I think he certainly carries the far left flag very well, the very far left flag. But you know, I'd be hard-pressed to... You know who might be that person who would be interesting? The closest person that pops to mind for me would be Elizabeth Warren.
Well, I'll agree with you that, there as well. You know what, now that you bring up her name, picking her out of the party, but here again, I guess what we're actually identifying are two individuals who, from a vision standpoint, maybe you could make the argument they're actually not envisioning something that's all that new. What they are envisioning is a realignment and refocusing on where our priorities ought to be as a country. And it ought not to be with the 1% of the 1%. It ought to be with what is right and best for the huge and disappearing middle class, which I will say, and I will hold to this until somebody can prove me wrong, I think we can trace back to the abject failure of the 30-year experiment that is trickle-down economics. It's only made things worse. Every time
I wouldn't disagree with you, but I would add an asterisk to it. Okay.
Go ahead.
The so-called experiment of trickle-down economics, like many experiments that we try, have never been tried properly. So I'll give you another similar example. We've never really tried anti-Keynesian or Hayekian economics. We've never really tried Keynesian economics properly, because this idea of, you know, investing when you need to invest, when economic times are tough, then you go ahead and you invest, and you actually bring people into government jobs, and you use that time for and money for infrastructure, and it's okay to have to run a deficit, and all of that is classic Keynesian, but it's only half of it. The other half is you have to, when times are good, you're supposed to pay it back. And everybody forgets that part of the Keynesian equation. People also forget that Republicans historically, as much as they pretended to embrace trickle-down economics, they too are Keynesians. And all you have to do is look at the military budget. It's not a question of whether they want to spend money they don't have in order to invest in the future of the country. They all do. They're all Keynesians, right? So
right.
We never really tried trickle-down in any real way, because
I would disagree with that statement that the trickle-down economics has been tried in significant ways, and certainly not in pure fashion. It's not a laboratory. It's not a perfect attempt at implementing the kind of policies that favor the wealthy with the expectation that doing so it benefits the rest. I think you would agree. We have been on that track for a long time.
See, I'm not sure I agree, because, again, if you look a little bit into the famous back of the napkin Laffer curve and all of that, there are a couple things in it that really were ignored. One of them, and there are two very significant things. The first one is Laffer himself, when he drew the curve, said there is a point at which these lines cross. There is the Laffer curve basically says there is an ideal point for taxes, and it's probably, in Laffer's world, lower than it is today, right? But there, at that time, lower than it was at that time. But Laffer himself would look at today's rates, and he would say, you've overswung, and you've misinterpreted trickle-down if what you think is it's always going to be lowering taxes is going to be better for the economy. Laffer never said that. He never argued that. And he is on record as saying we are beyond the point that the Laffer curve would say is the ideal point for economic growth and tax revenues. So we didn't even really try the experiment. All we did was take the bullet point, the talking point, and go nuts with it. The other thing that Laffer said that was always part of trickle-down is that it fundamentally works when the trickle-down is coming on the basis of a manufacturing sector that is reinvesting that money. It was never meant to work for a service industry or a financial industry that was using it to have money create money. The money was supposed to be used to create jobs, and if it is essentially a manufacturing sector, that is in fact where a lot of it would have ended up.
Mm-hmm.
Plants would have grown, people would have kept the money, and it would have reinvested. But you're not seeing that at the financial services sector, because they're not building anything. They're only creating more bits and bytes in bank accounts, right?
Right.
And so there are fundamental things about the supply-side economics that really were never experimented with properly. It became this, you know, talking point that went nuts.
Well, you can't go.
So I question whether any of these economic experiments have ever been dealt with sincerely.
You know.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you can't go now because we need to have about four more shows on this topic.
Okay. Well, we also got a couple people in queue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, let me share with you what my thought was about Republicans in one word.
Please.
Equality.
Yes. You know, I think, and I read an article. It might have been in Salon, although that sounds like it probably would have been too snarky, so it would probably be somewhere else, where they were saying that is, if you look out to 2020 or 2024, that it will it might have been on one of these Sunday talk shows, that it will be absolutely ordinary for Republican candidates, major Republican candidates, to say, you know, gay marriage is okay and you know, all of that kind of stuff.
If they don't, they won't be here to say it.
There's always that question of who's really going to come out to the primaries and who's going to be controlling those voices. But I do think that we're headed in that direction, even with the candidates today.
When a Republican ticket in a major race somewhere at the state level or above, you know, has their first, gay Hispanic candidate, I believe it.
Yeah. Well, that's a good point. But even just to there was this episode of The Newsroom last week. I don't know if any of you watched that on HBO, but it's fascinating because the main character played by Jeff Daniels is a moderate Republican who has been ripping into. I mean, I feel like he's Aaron Sorkin has gone and written me only with much better language and a much better actor. But I watched that show and it's like, you know, he's saying all the things I wish I could say quite that well. And it was really interesting to they had on this episode because they always deal. I'm sorry, again the setup. We're always looking at that show in its time. It's about a year and a half behind us, or thereabouts. And so we're seeing history. We kind of know what's happened, but we're seeing how a newsroom would go through it at that time. And so currently on the series, they're going through the 2012 debates. That's where they are in history in time. And they show the scene where a gay military officer who was at the time deployed in Afghanistan YouTubed in or whatever and asked the candidates a question, you know, when will it be okay for me to be open as I'm over here in Afghanistan fighting for you all? And the members of the audience booed. And, of course, that was fodder for the show, as it should have been fodder for all the candidates, which was the point that the show was making, is none of those candidates took the time to say, hey, wait a minute, how dare you? This guy is over there putting his life on the line to make sure terrorism doesn't come and affect your hometown. How dare you boo him? And not one of the candidates, including my favorite at the time, Hutzman, even bothered to make that point. And when we get to the point where there's even just that one candidate who will stand up and say, if you're going to boo a member of the military who's over there putting his life on his line for you just because he's gay, then please don't vote for me. I don't want your vote.
Yeah.
I'm not your candidate.
Wouldn't you love
when we have somebody stand up and debate a politician and say that on the Republican side, then I'll know change has really started to happen.
Yes. I agree.
I think you'd love to hear a politician
with that kind of courage.
I would love, and you know, I wrote a letter to Huntsman about it at the time. Of course, didn't get a reply, but then put it on my blog. So,
good enough for us.
Yeah, that equality is a good word. All right, well, let me get on to a couple more callers here. Thanks, Greg, as always. You and I, of course, will stay in touch as we always have.
Yeah, absolutely, my
and
pleasure,
thanks for calling in. Good thought. Thanks.
All right, bye-bye.
And we're going to take another very, very short break, and then we'll come back. We've got a couple more callers. You're listening to The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network.
Hello, everyone. This is John Cashin with the Coffee Party USA's Civics Minute. The Boston Tea Party is one of the most cherished stories from the founding of our country. This is one of the events that inspired the American colonists to stand up against tyranny imposed on them from the British government. Until 1764, the colonies were allowed self-rule, but with the conclusion of the French and Indian War in 1763, the British were low on money, so they decided to begin enforcing their trade laws to try to increase their capital. The British began to go after smuggling by searching colonial ships and convicting colonists in the British Admiralty courts. This enraged the colonists because the violators weren't given a trial by jury. Also, the British began levying taxes against the colonists on a whole host of articles, as well as tea, from sugar, coffee, stamps, and even dice and playing cards. The British didn't think they were being harsh on the American colonists, but the Americans disagreed. They believed the troops garrisoned in the colonies weren't needed since the French threat had been removed. Why would they want to pay taxes for garrisons that were only there to make sure the American colonists stayed in line? The colonists always received permission in the past from England for levying their own taxes, but now that right was being taken away, and because they didn't have their own representation in the British Parliament, they were being denied their own traditional rights as English subjects. This was going too far. In regards to the Tea Act, the British government gave the East India Company permission to transport tea, duty-free, from Great Britain to America to sell. Because they didn't have to pay the duty, it meant they could undersell the American merchants who sold tea, which would monopolize the tea trade. This would drive many colonists out of work. The Bostonians felt that something had to be done. If they allowed the tea to land and be offloaded, then the British would have had a moral victory in that the colonists were finally paying the tax they created for them. Also, there were many Tories, though still loyal to England, which would have had no problem with buying the tea. Destroying the tea seemed to be their only option. Stay tuned for more Civics Minute segments as you listen to your favorite Coffee Party USA Blog Talk radio shows. From Paducah, Kentucky, this is John Cashin. Good day, everyone.
Welcome back to the Middle Ground. That was John Cash on Civics Minute, heard on all of our internet radio talk shows. And just quickly to remind everybody what those are, Monday nights, of course, Press 1 for Democracy with Dan Aronson, who we're going to queue up and talk to in just a second, who's calling in, I believe, to give me a hard time. Tuesday nights, The Middle Ground, of course, the show will go on, Eric Beiler, and I'm sure at least for a while, a rotating series of guest hosts. And we have Lunch with Loudon on Thursdays with Janine Loudon, and on Saturdays, of course, Politics Done Right with Egberto Willis. And John Cashon showing up both to ask for your help in his donation minute as well as to give us all a little bit of education in the Civics Minutes series. We're talking tonight about the words Republican, Democrat, and Independent, and not what we think of when we hear those words, but what we wish we were thinking of when we hear those words, what our vision of those words means in 2016 or 2020 down the road when hopefully it all sort of starts to come back and the pendulum starts to swing a little bit more calmly, shall we say. Let's go to Dan Aronson out in Oregon. Mr. Aronson, welcome to the show. I'm sure the first thing you're going to do, because since I know that you are not a fan of either party, or perhaps parties in general, is you're going to rip me one about limiting the scope of the conversation. But, hey, it's my show, right?
Oh, if you read the chat, I said I would, but it's your last show. So I'm actually going to go in a completely different way, and I'm going to ask you to do me a favor, because I have a soapbox that I get to climb up on for a couple hours every Monday night. So I'm going to give a very quick answer to your question, and then I'm going to ask you a question. I would very, very, very much like you to expound on my question. But real simple for me, I'll go with kind of Greg's one-word answer. The Democrats, I want to see them – the word for them is refocus. I believe last week I espoused the fact that what I used to think of them, you know, champions of the poor, champions of the working class – let's do what's right for the most amount of people. I want to see a refocus on that. I believe they've lost that totally. And then the Republicans need, and they need, and we're going to need that both. The word for the Republicans, flexibility. I believe the Republicans have become, in large part because of the Tea Party influence, intractable. And they're the party of I'm drawing a line in the sand and forget it. I'm not crossing it. So if those two things happen to me, I think we get progress. I think we have that pendulum swing. I think we see the middle class make a comeback. I think maybe we see industry make a comeback to some extent, manufacturing sectors. And we see more freedoms come back as well that have disappeared largely, weirdly, under the Democratic presidency of President Obama. So I those are all the things I'd like to see. Now, here's what I'm asking you. You have been
along. Do I get to comment before you launch into your question?
Sure. Absolutely.
Can you? Is there a time in history where you could point to sort of as a reference where you would say that's when these two qualities were there?
Post-World War II, I would say, during the growth, when we and I think that's something to be – there's something to be said for peacetime presidencies versus wartime presidencies. I think as long as we're embroiled in very costly wars that are going to maximize budgets, like you had said, for military, I don't see much chance of our economy really getting better.
So you're thinking Eisenhower?
Reagan – Well, even Reagan, like you said, even Reagan, Clinton, where we had this just a little more of a relaxed time. Even those that era, I think
you saw
a lot more cooperation, a lot more reaching across the aisle, a lot more reaching across the aisle during those presidencies.
Well, I think we may have. There may be a little bit of rose-colored glasses with Clinton. First of all, it wasn't peacetime. I mean, there was Bosnia, but not on the scale. There certainly was no Vietnam, nor was there in Iraq. And certainly, the reaching across the aisle may be up until Gingrich, the Gingrich wave came in, but it got intractable for a while there as well.
Well, okay, so that leads me to my question.
That
leads me to my question. I think Eric muted me because the jet boat went by. I'm right on the river, and these big jet boats with hundreds of people go by, and they're loud.
Okay.
So that leads me right to my question. You've painted a nice picture. I love it. I'd like to get there. If Citizens United is not overturned, will we ever get there? Do we have a hope of getting to the place where you see – What your vision is of 2020?
Boy, that's a really good question, Dan. I think the answer is yes. For a couple of reasons. One is that, and I've expressed this before and I've written about this, there's a tremendous amount of focus on Citizens United, but a lot of the money that has just exploded in politics is not money that wouldn't have been allowed if Citizens United were not around. Okay? There's no question that Citizens United has, in my mind, there's no question that Citizens United has had an impact. But lots of the money that's flowed in would have flowed in anyway. Irrespective of Citizens United. So Citizens United alone wouldn't do that. I also believe that that certain parts of the system, let me say it another way. The biggest pieces of what I believe are dysfunctional in our political choice system, the fact that we have two parties, the fact that there's a tremendous need for fundraising, the fact that money buys a certain level of influence, this is not news. What's happened is scale, and Citizens United has been a factor in that scale, but not the biggest factor by any means. There are many other factors. For example, one of the biggest factors was the disappearance of the equal time rules, which had an inherently limiting it was a counterforce to the kinds of rhetoric that we're exposed to today in many ways. So I think there are other things that could also be done. The money in politics alone, there were times in our history when we still had good people fighting the good fight, whoever you are and however you define the good fight. without the levels of corruption and the levels of isolation and partisanship that you see today. So I think that, that Citizens United is a smaller piece of a system than and is not the system itself. So that's a long-winded answer. I think fundamentally the question is, can good, honest, moderate people survive in the system as it is today long enough to have an impact? And you look at an Olympia Snow and you say, no. I mean, you look at, is it La Tourette who's announced he's not running again? And you say, no, these guys are getting wiped out by the system the way it is. But with a little bit more of a push, maybe they don't leave. Maybe they are around. You get McCain, who's got nothing to lose anymore, and is finally showing the moderate stripes that I knew was there, that I knew were there all along, and many of us did and hoped for. So I think if the right visionary with the right message who can fight his way through the primaries, maybe it's a Huntsman, maybe it's a Chris Christie. And yes, I know, the magic words, fight through the primaries. And, you know, and they're a miracle. There, I need the Hogwarts professor with the magic wand again.
Yeah.
But
see Bush v. McCain. We got the one guy and not the other guy. Ouch. It was a short battle. It didn't take long for Bush.
But let's remember what came out of 2012, okay? Of those who packed themselves into the clown car in 2012 for the Republican candidacy, while they all had to talk the way they had to talk, the guy who came out was the most moderate candidate, the guy who won the nomination. And the question is, how do you know, can you win if you can't back away from that once you go through the primaries? But I've kind of accepted the fact that the best Republicans are going to have to be disingenuous to get through the primaries. It's sad, but I'm sort of willing to make that ethical trade to get maybe a Huntsman, into the race, somebody like that.
Right. Now, can I tell you one more
question? I do think it is possible, even if Citizens United is not overturned. I don't think it's possible unless a lot of people keep the pressure on the political incumbency system and the political fundraising system. If organizations like the Coffee Party suddenly decide to give up on that focus, or Root Strikers, or Move to Amend, I'm not big on the amend point, but they are keeping focus. If we lose focus on this, and the issue goes underground, then I think there's a problem. But as long as the issue stays front and center, even if Citizens United isn't overturned, I do have faith.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure.
If you have to go to the next caller, go ahead.
We've
got 81 million people that didn't vote. We've got a block of disenfranchised voters bigger than the size that voted for either candidate in 2012. You keep talking about this visionary leader, and I'm there. I am right there with you. What's his message or her message that is going to unite and galvanize the majority of the nation to do something different than what we've been doing for the last 30 years?
I honestly don't know. I think it could be a few different things. I don't know what the message is. I know messages that would excite me. Okay. And they're the kind of visionary messages. And let me just quick commercial break here.
Okay.
You know, I've talked in the past, I don't mean literally a commercial break, but a little backstory here. I've talked in the past about politics in New Hampshire and how they're different than other places I've lived. I don't know if they're different than everywhere, but they seem to be. And the ability to sit in a living room with a few dozen people and listen to John Huntsman talk during the campaign cycle. I don't think many people get that kind of an opportunity to sit that close to a candidate and to ask the candidate questions. And it's not about what questions I asked him, but one of the things that Huntsman was talking about, and it never came through, he never did a good job expressing this in the debates, but when you were sitting 15 feet from him, his face lit up. He talked about having a blue sky vision, and he admitted he didn't know what it was going to be yet. But that this country needed something like the going to the moon, like the interstate highway system. He came up with a couple of examples, the civil rights movement, something that was just so dynamic and nobody could argue against it, that it was just so big. And to lay down that and draw a line in the sand the way Kennedy said, and said, we're going to do this. And for me, if somebody said, you know, 8 years from now when my presidency is over, this country's educational system, our kids will be number one in math, science, and English on all world measures. That's what we're going to do. That's what my presidency is devoted to, and that's what I'm going to make happen. Right? How can anybody argue with that? And by the way, I intentionally didn't pick climate change because then you immediately argue over the people who deny it. But you can't deny that we're not number one in everything. Everybody admits that. There's no politician out there who's going to say we are not. They may say it, but they all know we're not. And that's a message to me that everybody would go, yes, let's do that. Let's be great again. And that's the kind of message that I'm hoping somebody brings to the table. I don't think it's a message about the middle class, because inherently there's class distinctions in that, and you're going to get haves and have-nots. I don't think maybe it's about bringing back the best-made products in the world and revitalizing the manufacturing industry. I don't think that has the dream quality cachet as what I've just described maybe for education, but some kind of vision like that, I believe, is what is really needed to jerk this country out of its complacency, out of its partisanship, and will motivate maybe a big chunk of those 81 million people to get to the polls.
I'm in. Sign me up.
You're in? You like it. You want me to run?
I'm in. Well, you've got free time now on Tuesdays. You can start working on that.
That's right, for campaign planning. Yeah. That'll never happen.
It's been a pleasure, sir, an absolute pleasure, and I look forward to continuing our discussions, even if offline. And hopefully maybe you'll call me the show sometime.
I will. Now you're now on 2 hours earlier, right?
1 hour. I started your bedtime. I start right at 9.
Oh, at 9. No, 9's not bad.
Okay.
My bedtime is more like 9:30, so maybe I can get the first part of the show. All right.
Yeah, we'll reserve a space for you in front of the show.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
Thank you. So, you know, Eric, I'm curious. I feel like I've kind of eaten up big chunks of the show, and I haven't really been a good co-host to you. But I'm kind of curious. You know, what kind of vision would you be looking? First of all, do you sort of buy into the idea that I guess maybe Greg brought up initially, this idea of a visionary president, and what for you would be that kind of a vision that you think could really bring the country together again the way those other presidents did?
Well, all of those things would work just fine if the overwhelming majority of Americans and a decent majority in both of the major political parties saw America as a country that includes everyone, including the bad guys in your pro wrestling show. And I think a lot of us thought that Barack Obama's emergence would suggest that America is preferable to the one we've been stuck in since really the founding, but especially since the Civil War, and that those people who resisted would be a minority, and the rest of us would push the country forward into a new 21st century that was inclusive and welcoming. And the idea of civic culture was one where the country really does come first. That's what we thought. But what we saw was a backlash that was very much reminiscent of what happened when the federal troops left the South and Reconstruction was ended, and basically a savage partisan war unfolded. And I mentioned that county in North Carolina that was basically, you know, the black people were removed in the 20s and 30s. And since then, politics has been very simple in North Carolina and in that county, but in the state as a whole, and that is that one of the parties represented white privilege, white supremacy, basically, more than the other one. And that was the party that tended to dominate. And any argument about, a living wage or any issue was done within that party, which stepped forward and said, I represent white power, right? And until we let go of that calculus, then it doesn't matter who steps forward. We mentioned FDR earlier. FDR was forced to accept that America wants a New Deal, but not for blacks. And so he wrote into the policies in order to get them through that black people would be excluded from the New Deal. Well, Barack Obama couldn't make that deal. He couldn't make that compromise. But he wasn't going to get anything through unless he did, right? So that's the thing, is that America has to grow into the America we were always destined to be before we can have a single leader lead us in that direction. The only way we've been able to have a single leader lead us in any direction up till now has been when that leader was willing to make a secret deal with the people who had black people removed from their county, with basically the white power base, whether it was implicit by going to regions of the country or towns in the country where there's a certain white supremacist lineage to announce your candidacy for president, or whether it's implicit in your campaign ads or whether it's implicit in your platform, or recently, I think since Barack Obama became president, it's been explicit. But however you communicate that, if that's what you're putting forth as a platform and you force the country to choose between that and everybody else, well, then we're not going to be able to move forward, because there are always going to be people who would rather see the country fail than succeed in going one of those two directions.
It's a really good point. We talk a lot about the parties and the differences between the parties, but the white, non-white issue is overwhelmingly more important, and not only for the purely demographic and the implications of demographic change on the political parties themselves, but simply for the fact that that is sadly a transpartisan issue. In many cases, the problem to be solved by the white majority was maintaining a power base as whites. And historically, there have been times when that has been in the Republican Party as it is today. And as you know, the vehemence of it is to some degree an unintended consequence of a particular political strategy that began pre-Nixon and blossomed under Nixon, the Southern Strategy. But there was a time when these exact same people that you're talking about were the Democratic Party. And it kind of points out the fact that that issue, the one you brought up, is probably the one that we should be spending more time talking about than any other. And many people are, because the parties will rotate wherever they need to rotate. The members of those people who believe in white supremacy and want to be a white majority for power for purposes of power and because of bigotry, will ride under the umbrella of whatever name will allow them that power or support them in their quest for that power. And it just happens to be Republicans today, or Tea Party in many cases. But we do get hung up on the fact that those people today belong to a political party, but the idea that if that party loses, that those people somehow go away, I think is a foolish one. That's not a party problem.
Well, I know we have Lee Beaumont waiting in the wings, and maybe another caller, but really quickly, as far as money in politics, I had a dog. Well, it was my girlfriend in my 20s. She had a dog named George, who knew a lot of great tricks. And if she was gone for a little while, she would come back and her dog would do all her tricks at once. Sit down, roll over, speak, everything right, all at once. She was so happy to see her master. And I think what we're seeing right now is that there are power legacies in the United States who recognize that this is probably the last time that we toggle between Democrats over Republicans representing white power. That white power isn't really going to be a reliable political platform ever again in the United States. No one's rolling out all their tricks. Yes, and so they're doing.
And so they're rolling out all their tricks. No, you're right. We laugh at the analogy, but you're right. And they're cool tricks, right? It's gerrymandering. It's voter suppression. It's money in politics. You're right. They're rolling them all out. It's a very good analogy, actually. You should write a blog about that. That's a good one. No, seriously, that's a really good. That's a good, an excellent metaphor.
Well, the dog doing all the tricks at once is such a lovely, charming thing to see. I'm not quite as enamored with what I'm seeing right now in North Carolina and around the country.
I totally understand that. Well, let's go. We've got just a few minutes left. Lee Beaumont out in New Jersey has been waiting very patiently for the better part of 3/4 of an hour. Lee, thank you for your patience. Welcome to the Middle Ground. And we've got just a few minutes, but what's on your mind?
Thank you very much. I offer one word, and it's the word statesmanship. I don't think we hear it very often. And I think that's what we want from our elected officials. What is it? I think it's a rare combination of wisdom and courage. What is wisdom? Wisdom is at least the sort of vision that we've heard about here. You talked about the moonshot. You talked about John Huntsman picking one. I don't think you can pick just one. I'm an engineer. I benefited greatly from the emphasis on the moonshot and so on. But was that the most – wasn't that one-dimensional? Did that really pull us forward as much as something else could have? I think the wisdom part of this is having a vision across many dimensions here. Why don't we have a tax code that people can understand? Why don't we have a Republican congressman that doesn't block vote?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I agree with you, I'll let you finish your point a minute, but just on that point, I think there's a difference between not a difference. I think there's an important quality in making sure that we have a leader with wisdom and visions across a number of areas. Absolutely
right.
Agree with you, but I also think there's value in a single unifying blue sky dream. Even while all those other things are being done, because I think unifying the country under that blue sky dream actually paves the road, for many of these other things, because you begin to embrace the idea that this person is a leader. Okay?
If I had to pick one vision, it's broadly the vision of well-being for all. And that's a broader vision than any particular thing. Well-being includes enough finances to get things done, enough education to move things forward. If there's inequality, it's not well-being for the down people and so on. But it may just be too abstract to go forward.
I think you would probably in if we look at history and the way these things kind of cranked out. And what motivates people when you make something tangible and visible? So if you can somehow get people to imagine in very concrete terms, right? So if you turn that in and said, by the end of my term, I'm going to make sure that every child in America gets 3 square meals a day,
right?
Would be a way of saying well-being, but
right.
Boy, who can't get behind every kid having 3 square meals a day?
Yeah. There are probably people. But that brings me to the second part of statesmanship, which I think
there's a few, right?
but yes,
I agree. I think wisdom and courage are good words.
Yeah, courage is the other part of it, which is, on the one hand, you elect a representative to represent the people. But on the other hand, I think you need a statesman who has the courage to say, I've looked at this fairly broadly. I've looked at what's on the table here. And while you might not want to go with this vote, this is the way I want to go. These are the reasons for it. And I really think in the long term here, this is the right thing to do. So you're not a robot representing the 10% that come out in the primary, but you're a statesman who's integrating all of this stuff, who's using the wisdom to give the vision, who's using the courage to say, this is what I'm going to do, and who is there to move us forward, not just his own political career. So
I think that's a really good point. The let me make just one quick comment, and then we've just got a few minutes left, so I want to move back to Eric. There was an interesting stat I saw, and again, I'm not sure where I saw it, but if you go back 30 or 40 years, that the typical representative, the typical congressional representative, voted with their party, voted along party lines, somewhere between 70 and 82 or 83% of the time, which in today's environment would be considered, you know, party treason.
Right.
Where if you're not up above 95, you're considered a rhino or a dino or a communist, like, you know, Representative King has been called. And we need to get back to that. You know, back then, people were willing to look at, you know, constituencies and their own consciences and vote for what they thought was best rather than just towing the party line. Very much. Thanks for calling, Lee. We're down to just a couple minutes. I apologize for cutting you just a little bit short. My fault for babbling on and on so much this evening. But as always, good to have you on the show, and appreciate your calling in.
Thank
you. So we're down to just the last few minutes on the middle ground. Eric, I'm why don't I give you the, you know, what? Let me just ask you, I don't know if you had a chance to kind of think through everything. What can people expect on the middle ground going forward?
Okay, well, first of all, I am going to take the question that you ask here and all of the questions that you've brought up during the many shows we've done together as sort of the quest for future shows, and not gonna respond too much to it right now, because I just wanted to take the last few minutes to thank you for the experience of sharing so much time on the phone on the radio, or in person for that one time when we were able to meet as part of the Coffee Party leadership team. I just wanted to thank you for that, because it really has been enlightening, educational, but also really enjoyable. And this is true for a lot of people, and unfortunately not many of them get to have this experience, but you know, you get so used to the labels and to the partisan jabs and the framework that comes from the political parties that dominate political discourse. And then you think, oh, my gosh, it's such a bruising, ugly place out there. Either you don't get involved, or you only get involved with people you agree with because you don't want to talk to people on the, quote-unquote, other side. But once you actually do and you have an experience that's good, it feels so much better, because you don't feel like the world actually is as bruising or as ugly as it's been presented to you, and it's liberating. So I want to thank you for that, and I think our listeners feel the same way. It's been a wonderful experience having this opportunity to basically witness history in the real newsroom with the real guy, not Jeff Daniels, Michael Charney. And I thought it would be great when I asked you to do this, and it has been, and I thank you for it.
Well, I thank you very much for those kind words. It has been a blast. I've looked forward to it every Tuesday night. You know, when we've had guests, when we've had free-for-alls, when we've had when shows take right turns and left turns, no pun intended. and of course, the callers, as always, have been great. And I will continue to listen in, and I certainly will call in now and again. I'm not stepping away from my interest. At all, I'm stepping away for other reasons, and I know the show will go on, and I know you will find a suitable voice to sit in my seat. I think we do have something kind of unique on this show, in the way we approach things, and the kind of insights from both sides. We're not afraid to argue a little bit with each other, but always keeping it civil and always being willing to listen. We're not two guys, and I hope our callers all would agree here, that we're not two guys who basically wait for other people to finish so we can talk, but we're two guys who actually take the time to listen and think about what the other person is saying. So for me, it's been a great experience as well.
That's true, actually. By creating that culture here on the show, it gave us the opportunity to listen and learn from people around the country. It really expanded our horizons.
Yep, absolutely. And we've had people on this show from all stripes, from all four corners of Dan Aronson's matrix, regardless of party affiliation. That one goes out to you, Dan. Thank you, everyone, for the time that I've spent on this show. You've made it a wonderful experience. Always thank the callers. I want to also take a minute to thank the other people who have helped out with the show in sometimes less visible ways, and in particular the other show hosts who occasionally call in and keep us running and gunning on topic, Egberto Willis, Janine Loudon, Dan Aronson, who you heard tonight. I also want a couple of shout-outs for people who helped me get started on this when I didn't know what I was doing. Don Manning and Jessica English both were very supportive and very helpful. And a special thank you to Debbie Lynn Molyneux, who has worked behind the scenes for all of the things that I haven't been able to get done, to announce the show, to put the emails together, and to promote the show. And I want to thank her personally if she's listening, either now or on the archives. Debbie Lynn, you've been great. And, of course, Eric, it's been a joy working the show with you, and we will continue, I'm sure, to stay in touch and be involved in other efforts. Thank you for everyone for the time you've given us. This is The Middle Ground, and for the last time, signing off, this is Michael Charney with co-host Eric Beiler. Good night.
That's our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow The Middle Ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong, and be heard.